Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 131, which is the very first part in a series looking at Burmese amber. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Javier Luque of Harvard University, and we put his recent discovery of a crab preserved in amber into context. We'll be discussing everything to do about crabs, from how they live and how they grow, to when they evolved and what their fossil record is like. Also, why do things keep evolving into crabs? This sets us up perfectly for the second part of the interview, in which we take a look at the specifics of this remarkable fossil itself. But as always, we've got our admin to get out of the way, so firstly, apologies for the delay in getting an episode to you, and I'm sure you'll all know why by now, and yes, I had another short notice stay on an oil rig. It's all part of the job, I'm afraid, but it means that I can't record or take any equipment with me. Secondly, having launched our Patreon account last episode, I wanted to thank and welcome all of our new backers. If you've not yet checked it out, please follow the links on our website and social media channels, and take a look at the reward tiers we have to offer. This month, we'll be releasing our annual review show and also the first of our invited lectures, so please sign up if you wish to see those. Finally, and as always, if you enjoy the show, please like, share, comment, or leave a rating. Anything you can do on social media really helps the episode reach as many people as possible. Remember, the images to accompany this episode are on our website, paleocast.com, where you can also find all of our past interviews and much more. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Javier. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me.
We always like to start our interviews off with getting to know a bit more about you. So can you tell us what your route into paleontology was, please?
I wanted to become a paleontologist since I was around 4 years old. And this is way before the, or not that way before, but before enough from the Jurassic time era of movies. I was drawn into paleontology because an expedition we did with my parents to a part of Colombia, South America, my home country, that is rich in fossils from the Cretaceous period, mostly marine reptiles and ammonites. And the fascination about how an organism can be preserved through time and yet make it to today in such a way that we can take a glimpse into a distant past was so fascinating that I knew from an early age, I wanted to become a paleontologist.
Did your parents have any background in paleontology themselves, or did they just think it was going to be a nice day out?
Not at all. They have normal, regular lives. I was the one collecting, you know, rocks and bugs and beetles and tadpoles and bones of dead animals. But they were always very encouraging. Even though my room looked like a little museum, they were always happy to see how excited I was about the natural world.
Oh, it's good that they supported you with it, because I don't know what it's like to have a four-year-old, but I expect that if you took them for a single day out thinking that would be the end of it, but then 30 years later or however long it is, they're still
full-on
paleontology.
I am very lucky that I got to stick to my childhood dream of becoming a paleontologist. No, that doesn't often happen, right?
Yeah. So my follow-on question to this is always, what would you be doing if you weren't a paleontologist? Was that never an option for you?
Since I was that age and during my childhood, I knew I wanted to be an ologist, archaeologist, anthropologist, biologist, geologist. And it was through my undergrad experience that I was exposed to geology as a career. Basically because in the pensum and the syllabus of the curriculum, they had a class on paleontology. And that's why I am, my undergrad is in geology, and then I follow up the path towards biology, because paleontology bridges both worlds, the geo and the bio. Now, if it wasn't for that, I would be a biologist or an archaeologist or who knows what else, but something that involves digging things from the past.
But a lot of our interviewees always have some kind of secret talent or a multi-talented. You play an instrument? Do you dance better than anyone else on the dance floor? Is this doesn't have to go in if there's nothing there.
That's awesome. I enjoy painting and drawing very much, and I like sculpting, do like manual activities. Music has never been my forte, but one of the, let's say, good things out of this pandemic is that I got to also start fulfilling a childhood dream of playing violin. So I got myself one violin.
Wow.
I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm just making it sound somehow. So, but it's good. I don't have to be good at it. As long as I enjoy the process, it is what it matters. And I do dance a little bit. As a Latino, salsa is one of my favorite things to do. Dancing salsa doesn't mean that I'm great at it, but I sure enjoy it.
Good. So presumably now you're back in the office in Harvard. What are you currently working on? What are your research projects?
Right now, I am working on different projects that align with my overall research interest on understanding the evolution of organisms through time and space, with a particular focus on the tropics. And we are very lucky that the tropics are the places with the most diversity in the world in terms of species richness, and that allows me as a tropical paleontologist explore questions about what are the mechanisms that have led to today's diversity. Something that is curious but not surprising is that despite of this, of the tropics being hotspots of diversity and being regarded as cradles as and museums of diversity by some, it is the place where we know the least about their fossil record. So in order to make sense of our present, we have to take a look at the past. And that's my motivation to study the fossil record in the tropics. And crustaceans, particularly crabs, shrimps, and lobsters, that are all together called decapods, they have a really good fossil record. And many of these groups have their highest diversity and species richness in the tropics today. The new fossils we have been discovering are also helping us shift paradigms and change the narrative about the timing and place of origin of several groups that have been regarded as high latitude in origin, moving to the tropics, and now we see a different pattern. So part of my projects include collaborating with a group of colleagues in a project funded by the National Science Foundation to assemble the crab tree of life and investigate why do things keep evolving into crabs. And this is done with friends and colleagues from Harvard University and Florida International University and a net of collaborators from abroad. Another project I'm working on is on the evolution of compound eyes and visual systems. And fortunately, compound eyes being hard parts of the exoskeleton, they can also fossilize. And crabs are special because most arthropods out there have one specific eye type. And one is compound eyes, called the apposition eyes. But decapods and crabs in this case have up to four different eye types. So how is that an organ so complex like an eye can be so plastic and evolve different forms and functions?
It sounds like you're busy.
There's always room for more.
Okay, with the tropics and tropical paleontology, with continental drift, the rocks that you're looking at are rarely from the place where they were originally deposited. For instance, the work that I've been doing in the Arctic, that used to be in the tropics in the Silurian. So does that lead you all around the world?
Yes, it has. because the tropics are dynamic and they shift as the time progresses and the plates reaccommodate themselves, it has allowed me to investigate different moments of time and space. But one of the beautiful things about the tropics to date, at least the tropical South America or tropical Americas, is that they have been in a tropical position since the breakup of Gondwana. We're talking about that for most of the Mesozoic and the Xenozoic, northern South America has already been in a tropical position, which doesn't require traveling to that far to keep putting those dots together in a similar latitudinal context.
So you could actually study the rocks that you went to as a four-year-old.
Yes, indeed. And here I am trying to fulfill my childhood dream.
So I know you from your work on decapods. I've come across a lot of that work and stuff as I've been looking around at my own kind of arthropod fossils. How did you begin working on decapods? Where did that interest develop? Has it always been crabby things, or were you most interested in dinosaurs when you were little?
As probably most kids, being paleontologists or not, I was fascinated by dinosaurs and big megafauna and teeth and bones. And of course, I wanted to study dinosaurs. Who doesn't? They are amazing. They are interesting. They captivate our imagination. But it was at the end of my undergrad career when I was doing a 1-month-long field expedition that one afternoon, after walking for many hours and kilometers, I just sat down to take a break, and we were looking for a specific rock type from a specific moment of time in the Cretaceous. And I started just hammering rocks at 6 p.m. when I came across a layer full of fossil arthropods, things that at first I thought were spiders. But then these spider-looking things had long tails with segments, and then they had also pincers, and they had things that do not match with spiders. And the more I learned about them, the more I recognized these are not spiders, they are crustaceans, and these are actually decapod crustaceans, things like shrimp, lobsters, and crabs. And when I tried to do some preliminary research about what do we know about the fossil record of decapods in my country, in Colombia, where these first discoveries happened, I realized very little to nothing was known. So I took into the work of digging further into the matter, and the more I learned about fossil crustaceans, the more I fell in love with them.
Yeah, it happened for me as well. You just start digging away at something, and it's like pulling a piece of wool on a jumper, and soon you're just pulling more and more, and you just can't get enough of it. You just completely fall in love, and it just takes you off on a tangent that you never thought you'd be going down. And then once you're in there, you can't think about anything else.
That's absolutely right.
So we've spoken about decapods on Paleocast before. It wasn't too long ago, in episode 96, I have that written down. But as a refresher, could you tell everyone what a decapod actually is?
Absolutely. Decapods are a group of crustaceans distantly related with krill, pillbox or rollipolys, amphipods, etc. Decapods are characterized by having 8 pairs of thoracic appendages, from which the first 3 pairs are acting as mouthparts, and the other 5 pairs of limbs are acting as grasping appendages like pincers or claws, or as walking legs, hence the name Decapoda, 10-footed crustaceans.
And when do we first see them in the fossil record? Have they been around for a long time?
Well, decapods are first known from late Devonian fossils over 365 million years ago. But molecular phylogenies have predicted that they can have an origin dating back into the Silurian or even the Ordovician over 400 million years ago. We don't have the fossils for them yet, but we will expect to find something decapod-looking in those time frames as well.
And do you have a favorite fossil decapod?
I do have several favorite fossil decapods, but there is one that has a special spot in my heart, and its name is Calichimera perplexa, which has been called the platypus of the crab world, and even has been called the baby Yoda of the crab world by the people from the PBS eons. That's a great nickname, if you ask me.
And so, yeah, I'm sure that people might be aware of it from the PBS eons. If you don't know what it is, go and have a look. Coming into that with the PBS eons, I was going to say that crabs have received a whole lot of attention, a whole lot of love online recently. And maybe a lot of that has come from that episode of PBS eons. But there's now loads of memes about how things just keep on evolving into crabs. So I wanted to ask, like, where did all of that come from? Why are people interested in crabs and talking about them? But then also, what is a crab? Is it just the shape of an animal, its morphology? Is it how it lives, its ecology? Or is it an actual biological group? All of these things related to each other are crabs.
Well, crabs have fascinated us as humans for thousands of years. They have their own constellation and their own nebula, the Crab Nebula and the Cancer constellation. They have played important parts in the folklore, in parades and festivities. They have an important role in the fisheries, and we consume them, but some of the people who eat shellfish, and they have also a part in the aquaculture trade, and they resonate with different aspects of our daily lives. But also, they are very interestingly looking. Things that look like crabs are not crabs, and things that do not look like one end up being true crabs. So this fascination about the evolution of such a complex form and why different groups have led to similar body shapes is what has captivated the imagination of the public alike in the last few years. So for your question of what is a crab, crabs as a whole, all together, they belong to a group of decapods called Meiura, and they are derived from shrimpy, lobstery-like ancestors, which split from them over 260 million years ago, give or take. And that split gave birth to two main groups of Meiurans. One is the false crabs, Oranomiura, and the true crabs, or Brachyura. What we usually called as crabs, the things we have in mind as crabs, are mostly true crabs or Brachyura. Although we have things like hermit crabs and porcelain crabs and king crabs, that are also crab-looking, but they belong to a very different group.
Okay.
And for your question about whether a crab is a morphology, an ecology, or an actual biological group, well, both groups, the Anomurans and the Brachyurans, compared to their other decapod relatives, they have a shortened tail, reduced tail that is not fleshy and muscular as in a lobster or a shrimp. And such a tail in crabs can be also tucked underneath the body for protection. So now they don't have to drag this very delicious extension of their body, which in turn provides them with some protection from predation. Crabs also share a few features, including the presence of only one pair of grasping appendages in the front of the body, pincers or claws. The other four limbs tend to be walking legs, compared to shrimp or lobster, which can have from 3 to 5 pairs of clawed limbs. So both, crab can be actually both. It could be a morphology in itself, but also a natural biological group.
Okay, and what are the advantages of this crab-like morphology? You've talking about how the tail can stick to the underside of the body, which I never knew until I was like 30 that's what it was. Kind of looks like a pair of upside down underpants or something stuck on there. But are there any other advantages?
we can let's introduce a term here, and the term is carcinization, and it has been defined through time as the processes of evolving a crab-looking body form. And this carcinization, if we think of an archetypical crab, they have round, big bodies that are compressed dorsoventrally, and they have big pincers or claws and walking legs and a little tail tucked underneath the body. And it comes down to the flexibility of the body plan of a crab and what that implies in terms of reducing predation, occupying new spaces from the depths of the oceans to caves and rivers and even climbing trees. They also allow them to go more places that other decapods have never been able to go. The firm land, which shrimp and lobster are not famous for being terrestrial, but crabs have, and they have in fact conquered land and fresh water multiple times independently. So whatever the crab morphology comes from, it is giving them an edge to occupy new spaces that other of their distant relatives haven't been able to.
So one of the interesting things that came out of the decapod interview we did earlier is a discussion about the ontogeny, how they grow. And people will know that arthropods grow by having what we call instars. So they have like stages of growth in which in between everyone, they shed their exoskeleton. But that allows them to have different kind of shapes and exoskeletons in between. And some crustaceans can have ridiculously different kinds of shapes, overall shapes, between every stage in this life cycle. Do we see that in the true crabs? Do they ever have wildly different instars?
They do. They certainly do. In fact, they have very abrupt jumps between those stages. So tiny baby crabs start their life as a larval stage called zoea. And the zoea is characterized by this roundish carapace with a long rostrum, a very long frontal spine, and another similar extending backwards, big roundish eyes that are not concealed within orbits, and a long tail that they use for swimming with their feathery appendages or like swimmerets. And then they metamorphose through some of these zoea stages into a transitional stage between the larval and the post-larval called the megalopa. And megalopa means mega, big, and opa, eyes, so big eyes. And they look dramatically different from the zoea stages. And this interface between the zoea and the post-larval stages lasts for only one or two instars at all before morphing into the little tiny versions of what will become adults. So one of the things about crab evolution is that you can play with the evolution of different body forms by accelerating or delaying the timing of expression of some of those changes. And sometimes you can even produce juvenile looking adults by retention of some of those early characters, and something we call heterochrony.
So the classic crab morphology is just it's part of the latter stage of its life cycle. Does each one of those have a different ecology that's associated with it, a different way of life?
They do. Zoea are usually open water swimmers. They move in the water column in the pelagic realm. And if we talk about most crabs are benthic, they live in the floor, let it be the floor of the ocean or the floor of a jungle or the floor of a river. But they live at the bottoms. When it's the floor, I mean the bottoms. And the transition from a free swimming pelagic larval stage to a more permanent bottom dwelling adult form is bridged by this megalopa stage, which starts in the water column And then they find populations where other adults are already, and they recruit themselves into these populations by settling and then morphing into the final benthic stages.
Wait a second. I've just had a thought. So the terrestrial crabs, the one that lives in the jungle, what do they do for their first instar? Are they marine? And then each juvenile, as it becomes an adult, has to make the transition from marine to terrestrial?
That is a fantastic question that has a lot of branchings to it. The reason why is great because it's not straightforward. Some crabs, as I mentioned before, have colonized or conquered or have an incursion into non-marine habitats multiple times. And the way they have done it comes from different pathways. For instance, if we think about the Christmas Island red crab, they live in the forest. These huge land-dwelling crabs live in the forest, like thousands of meters, kilometers inland. And they undergo these massive migrations to the shores for the females to release their larvae at certain moments of the year where the tides allow them to swap the larvae offshore. And they undergo all of their larval stage metamorphosis in the ocean before these tiny bebes called megalopa return back to shore and start migrating upland to become post-larval, finally adults. So that's a huge change of habitat from an obligated marine larval stage to a fully terrestrial adult stage. But then you have things that are freshwater, and you have amphibious crabs that can move from land to freshwater in a more continental setting. And in many of these groups, the larva also has to develop, but they do not develop in the water column. Because think of a river, there is a dynamic. Most of the time, rivers are dynamic, so they are carrying the larva downstream, and they would end up in different places or eaten by anything else. So these crabs, like freshwater crabs, have evolved a strategy where they become direct developers. So the larva development happens in the belly of the mother, and they hatch as teeny tiny versions of the adults. So they have skipped that jump from having a water-dependent larval stage to a direct development that allows them to become to avoid predation and be able to settle as proper post-larval stages.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm in awe of crustaceans at times. Really, I am. Despite being a chelicera at
work. That's so weird. Well, they're all arthropods, and arthropods are fascinating by themselves, and they account for the vast majority of life in the planet, and not surprisingly why. They have done things very well since the early beginning.
So going into that much depth with this question, my next question is, why do they walk sideways? It's not quite as not quite as in depth as the last one, but hey.
That is also a question that requires a closer look at their crab tree of life and the evolution of carcinization, the crab-like form. Many crabs do walk sideways, and those are the typical crabs we can think of. Dungeness crabs and king crabs and ghost crabs and fiddler crabs, etc., etc. The reason they can do it and the reason why they do it is because their anatomy restricts their motion to happen that way. So if you think of an animal like a lobster, like a squat lobster, which is an anomura and a false crab, but it's more lobstery looking or shrimpy looking than crabby looking. They can walk back and forth, like frontwards, in the anterior posterior direction. The reason why is because they have a narrower chest, and the base of their legs, the coxa, are more space among themselves, allowing them for more degrees of motion. Same happened with a lot of other false and true crabs. But when these particular groups of true crabs become highly carcinized, their body expands laterally so much that their chest plates also expand a lot, bringing the legs way farther away from each other. And that has a consequence on the ways the limbs can be moved. And the best way to move when you have the legs that way is sideways. But they can also maneuver around it. So they do not always walk sideways. They can move back and forth, like front, back, but it's case dependent. So one of the other beauties of crabs, everything makes sense in the light of evolution, except crabs sometimes is a joke, because they can do so many things and they break so many of the rules that for every example of what they do, there is always an exception.
So you mentioned at the start, one of your research projects was looking at the visual systems, the eyes of decapods as a whole. Do they make good study systems for compound eye visual systems? And if so, why?
Most of the arthropods with compound eyes have the given eye type that is called the apposition eye. And that eye type allows the light from the exterior, from the outer world, to hit the retina via a single channel. Each of these unitary elements called omateria with their own lens can funnel the light down into the retina, like if it was pouring water in a glass. And even though this holds true for most, let's say, crustaceans in this case, with compound eyes, there are some groups, and pancrustaceans, including insects, some groups have evolved different ways of catching that light. And by doing so, they have also changed the way the eyes internally are structured, and even externally in the shape of their facets and their packing. A few of those examples are moths, a few groups of moths, few groups of nocturnal beetles, and crabs among decapod crustaceans. So this is fascinating, that an organ so complex and so specifically tailored to their ecology and what they do, it has the flexibility to evolve into different forms and functions. So one of the goals of our current research is to understand how the crab eyes have led to four different ways of doing the thing, seeing the world and capturing light from an ancestral eye type. What is really, really cool about this is that you can see different eye types in a single species through their ontogeny.
No.
So all baby crabs, it's so mind-blowing. All baby crabs start their life as larva with the apposition eye type. And they can facultatively migrate pigments back into their retina so they are not as shiny and they avoid predation in the water column. But that is like quote-unquote, pre-adaptation for what could become a completely different visual system in their post-larval life, such as superposition, where the light actually, the eye inside has a clear zone because of those pigments that are retreated back into the retina, that light from hitting different omateria can actually deflect and get to the retina from different pathways to optimize the light capture. But that can happen in a single species across their lifetime. And that is fascinating. How can you go from a larval apposition eye with hexagonal facets in a honeycomb packing to an abrupt superposition eye of the mirror type, where the facets are square and packed like in boxes and they operate mechanically very different? It is one of the questions we want to answer through my research and research with colleagues, but it's one of the most challenging because that imply taking a deeper look at things like ecology and development and their interplay with phylogeny.
So let's focus it down now on the fossil record of the brachyurans, the true crabs. When did they first evolve? When do we first see their fossils?
The first fossil brachyurans, or true crabs, that we can pinpoint in the fossil record are approximately 190 million years old. And the oldest representative of this is called Eocarcinus precursor. It comes from the early Jurassic of England. And the important thing about this animal is that it looks different than other groups of crabs, let's say the false crabs. It already sports a more crabby body form, and yet is not quite there into the crab body plan as we think of it today. In contrast with other crabs, like true crabs at least, Eocarcinus had really long antenna, whereas most living crabs have actually very short antenna, and fossil crabs too. And Eocarcinus also has a relatively long tail that is tucked backwards. It's like untucked outside of the body compared to most other crabs who have already reduced it and tucked it under the carapace. And the carapace itself is not roundish, flattened like a pancake. It's more like cylindrical, a little bit lobstery. So even though Eocarcinus precursor can be the oldest crab-like fossil known to date, it is still not the ancestor of the modern groups as we think of them right now.
So if this species of crab didn't have the classic kind of carcinized shape, were the true crabs the first ones to actually have this shape, or did they also convergently come across a carcinized shape themselves?
As we see it right now, we can envision the process of carcinization or evolving a proper crab-looking body form that to have happened at least five times among Meiurans or crabs in the broad sense. Three times within Anomura and at least two times within Brachyura. And I'm saying at least is because the fossil record can tell us otherwise, different pathways towards carcinization. But yes, this overall body anatomy construction can arise in different groups independently, which invites the question of what is so special about that body form that is making organisms innovate and evolving it independently so many times.
But which one was first?
The non-crab looking form. Is that what you mean? Did I answer your question? Apparently no.
It's not how many other times, it's are crabs the original crab-shaped things, or did they also convergently come across this crab shape?
Right. Okay. So in that case, and along those lines, there are other groups that have evolved somewhat crab-like body forms. And I don't want to say crab-like in the strict sense, but more like they have derived from elongated, more shrimpy ancestors into, or lobster ancestors into something that is more compact as a typical crab. A couple of those groups include Polychelidan lobsters, which are famous through the Jurassic and part of the Cretaceous. They are flattened, very flattened and broad. And those circular disc-like carapaces are more similar to the body that you would expect to see in a crab than in a lobster. And another example are cycloids. And cycloids are this really strange arthropod group. We still don't know what they are. They look like mites. They look like parasites in a way, flattened, circular, disc-shaped things that must have evolved from something different, something more shrimpy looking in a way, or more not carcinized. So carcinization per se can only be applied to crabs, but the phenomenon of undergoing such a dramatic shift of body form can be seen in some other groups. Funny or interestingly enough, none of those groups have made it to the same level as crab did, or have taken it to the level that true crabs have taken it.
Are there any noteworthy groups of extinct true crabs?
There are several noteworthy groups. I can think of some that are quite remarkable by their own means. One of them are called the Dacoticancroids. And these animals have a fossil record in the Cretaceous, mostly from North America and a few from Europe. And they are like any true crab that you can think of today. Very sturdy, roundish carapaces, tiny tails, big claws, etc. And yet they belong to an early stock of crabs that are typically not your crabby looking fossils. On the other hand, we have Calichimera perplexa, which is by itself a baffling offshoot in the crab tree of life, that instead of looking more like a crab or carcinized, it went the other way. It decarcinized. It sported a more elongated, fusiform body, more lobster-like body. Instead of having tiny eyes, it had two huge, round, big eyes that, if we put it in context, the size proportion to the body is like if you and I had eyes the size of volleyballs. And it also has a little tail that protrudes backwards, so it's completely drifting away from your typical crab body form. And these are fossils, right? So there is things about the evolution of form through time that can only be seen through the lens of the fossil record.
And how good is the fossil record of crabs in general?
The fossil record of crabs in general is good, especially when we get into younger rocks, let's say Cretaceous and the Cenozoic, because of the time and because there's more, has been more species evolving through time. It's a group that has become more diverse in both in terms of number of species and anatomy through time, but also in terms of the environments they inhabit that also enhances the preservation of such fossils. The earliest fossil crabs tend to be small coral reef dweller things, and most of the time the fossil record is restricted to isolated tiny fragmentary carapaces or remains of their claws. And it's during the Cretaceous, even though they have a Jurassic origin, it's during the Cretaceous that we start seeing them occupying different ecospaces, different habitats, doing different things, and then also being fossilized in different sediments, which allow for a more complete preservation. One of the good things is that by that time, true crab, robust claw, big pincer, big carapace groups already evolved, which facilitates their fossilization because of the sturdiness of their body parts.
And in these different environments, is the some that promotes the preservation of crabs, or there's some that we'll probably just never find fossils of crabs in? And so what I'm asking is there a bias in the fossil of record crabs that promotes those of a certain environment over another?
Absolutely. Most fossil crabs that we can think of, in fact, most crab species are marine, and they have been marine since the beginning of the group over 200 million years ago. And as such, they have more space to fossilize because there's more oceanic water than continental water, but also because those settings will allow for a more calm depositional settings that will preserve such fossils. When we move to continental or non-marine habitats, let's say mainland or freshwater, the environments themselves have way less preservational potential for animals such as crustaceans, in this case crabs, because they become disarticulated really fast and because their thin shells are crushed and dissolved really fast as well. And that's why we don't have a good fossil record of land-dwelling crabs or freshwater crabs. We can call them overall non-marine crabs. And that is an issue when we try to bridge the gap in our understanding of the timing and place and mode of invasion of novel habitats from a marine ancestor in crabs.
So if you were to find a crab that had a very strong association to the land, that would be quite impressive, wouldn't it?
Most definitely, and especially if such a fossil would happen to be a very complete one.
Kind of like your recent paper, perhaps.
Exactly, and that is one of those lucky strikes where all the factors allowing for preservation of a fossil help making a one-of-a-kind discovery that otherwise would be impossible to see in the fossil record.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.